This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, a Northeast Philadelphia motel was called the city's epicenter of human trafficking. A recent lawsuit holds the motel accountable for a teenager's two-year nightmare as a sex slave. We'll discuss whistleblower protection with the head of the Government Accountability Project in Washington, D.C. Did former FBI Director James Comey have whistleblower protection? We find out in this interview. Emmy Award-winning journalist Dave Saldana analyzes the state of investigative journalism in the United States. From Watergate to Russiagate, what impact is the media having on public opinion? Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Prosecutors have dubbed a Northeast Philadelphia motel the city's epicenter of human trafficking. Recently, a lawsuit was brought against the Roosevelt Motel for the pimping of a teenage girl in one of its rooms for a period of 2 years. It's the first lawsuit under a 2014 state law permitting victims of sex traffickers to sue hotels and motels where the abuse occurs. The suit was filed on behalf of a 17-year-old girl known as MB, who was sold into sexual slavery at the Northeast Philadelphia Motel at age 14. The lawsuit alleges that she was prohibited from leaving and was forced to commit sex acts with approximately 1,000 men. The hotel is known by the district attorney as the site of most trafficking investigations in that city. The National Human Trafficking Hotline says that 7,500 human trafficking cases were reported in 2016. That included 151 in Pennsylvania and 193 in New Jersey. Almost three-quarters of those involved sex trafficking, and nearly a third of sex trafficking cases occurred in motels and hotels. Joining us to talk about this case is attorney Nadeem Bazar of the law firm Klein & Spector in Philadelphia. Nadeem's practice concentrates on medical negligence, catastrophic personal injury, and cases involving child abuse and human trafficking, as well as sexual assault and Title IX violations on college and university campuses. Nadeem, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Your practice involves some personal injury, but also more difficult issues of child abuse and human trafficking. How did you get involved in handling this kind of case?
Sure. So I grew up, I like to say, in the law at a personal injury firm. I started initially handling the types of cases that personal injury lawyers do handle, and then started seeing cases and files involving children that had been harmed in what I call alternative placement settings. That's whether or not they were in foster care or in residential treatment facilities. And that combined with a few unusual cases where people had been physically and unfortunately sexually harmed in alternative settings like hospitals and apartment complexes. And then the two just sort of meshed together and turned into an area of practice.
And I would imagine that a lot of these young girls or women lack the resources to adequately bring legal cases against the perpetrators. How big do you think this problem is, especially in the Philadelphia area?
Yeah, so Heidi, you touch upon two really important points. First of all, in Philadelphia, unfortunately, it is a big problem, and it's a big problem that stems from what we start off with is our children that are either aging out of the foster care system, children that are running while in the foster care system, then just homeless children in general. And so these children find or seek out ways to just survive. I mean, they're looking for the basic necessities, and that's food and shelter and any kind of comfort they can get. And unfortunately, they find it in all the wrong places. In terms of how common it is, I would say it's on the fold of thousands of kids a year in just the Philadelphia area.
And I understand that in 2004, a state law was passed allowing victims of sex trafficking to sue certain facilities such as hotels and motels where abuse occurs. Was that the result of sort of hard-fought efforts from advocates, or how did that come about?
So around the country, there have been advocates and advocacy groups that have done just a terrific job in developing the rights for these children and these victims. There's been a federal statute in existence since 2000, and there's been many redos of that statute. States, now some 35 or more states, have adopted their own trafficking laws. And in 2014, Pennsylvania sort of crystallized an individual's right to bring civil suit on behalf of trafficked victims.
Okay, let's talk about the current case and the girl known as MB. She had been trafficked, I guess, at a motel in Northeast Philadelphia, and it began when she was age 14. Can you tell us how she got involved in this?
Yeah, so as I had referenced earlier, a lot of these children, like MB, start off in, unfortunately, bad family situations. She had been separated from her family and at times was required to fend on her own. She had lived in an apartment that was once inhabited by her parents and, you know, herself. Her parents had moved out. She was left to take care of herself and, unfortunately, met up with the wrong people.
In a lot of these cases, is substance abuse a part of how the abusers keep the girls involved in this?
Yeah, so another great question and a great point. So this kind of lifestyle and this environment has so many variables that are moving in and out. Substance abuse or drugs, alcohol, the threat of physical violence, not just chemical addiction, but emotional addiction, that is young children looking for anybody to take care of them. Unfortunately, that permeates many of the victims. In MB's case, MB was involved being forced into having sex with numerous men. The extent of her drug and alcohol involvement, though, is minimal.
And can you describe how she was found and how she came to your attention?
Sure. So I think that the traditional view that people have is sort of that Hollywood TV-type view of traffickers. That is, somebody transports people from another country. They come in a container that's docked somewhere in a port city, and then they're sort of trafficked out or moved out into hotels, motels, or sort of shady apartments where they're forced to have sex. The problem is actually much larger on a domestic front, and that is trafficking is the term that's used for people that sell other people. In this particular case, they don't always compel you to stay with them. They're not locked up in a basement. You're not hidden away in a hotel for days on end. What happened in MB's case, though, is that she met up with the wrong people. She was taken to a motel, this one in the Northeast, and she was forced to have sex for money with these men that were just rotating in and out of the hotel. That she was able to leave after hours when she was out of the hotel is an unusual circumstance, but she was at times permitted to separate herself. The reason why this is such a bad epidemic is because these children are looking for any identity to find some comfort. And unfortunately, it is with drugs and alcohol and the association with these people that are showing them attention.
Right. It becomes a kind of substitute family, I guess, sort of the way gangs do for some people.
Absolutely. And that's a great point. And as I said, the addiction doesn't have to just be drugs and alcohol. Sometimes it's an emotional addiction to somebody that's a substitute parent or guardian.
Well, let's talk about the situation in the hotel. I read an article that said it was a two-story motel, and MB was actually known by a lot of the staff, and that some people in the hotel even accepted money, and I'm going to use an antiquated term because I read it in one of the articles, they called him a pimp. I don't know what is the proper term for someone who abuses children for profit in this way.
To refer to it as an antiquated term is almost fair. When we're referring to traffickers, I think that the old school name would have been pimps.
Right.
And that conjures up this image of somebody who's just working street corners and forcing children or young adults into walking streets and doing things and being somewhat disorganized. Traffickers, I think, has taken on a new connotation, one, because it's international, and two, because it gives a sense of organization using the internet, newspapers, and having a system in place.
You know, I'm just going to throw in a random thought here, because when you mention organization, in the Bronx here in New York a year or so ago, there was a sweep of a public housing complex. Over 100 young persons were arrested under RICO for allegedly being part of gangs. And I wonder, could RICO theoretically be used to go after traffickers?
So I'm sure there would be situations where those statutes, the RICO statutes, would be effective in prosecuting traffickers. But at this point, I can tell you in Pennsylvania, the U.S. Attorney's Office and the District Attorney's Office has done just a terrific job under the trafficking statutes that give them sort of the ammunition they need to criminally prosecute these pimps or traffickers,
right,
as they're known as now.
That's good. So back to MB. How did she ultimately get out of this difficult situation?
MB eventually decided that she needed to get away from these people that were involving her in this business. She reached out to the Department of Human Services and got in contact with her family simultaneously. She was sort of, for lack of a better phrase, brought in, and that's what one of the terms that's used. And the City of Philadelphia Department of Human Services and her family sort of took over from there and have been trying to do right by her now for several years.
Oh, good. So her family is supportive.
She's back with her family. She has many supports in place, again, through the Department of Human Services, and she's just trying to get her horribly disrupted life back on course.
And in terms of, before we ask you some questions about the lawsuit, I'm curious about what kind of social support or counseling is available to young people who have been in this horrendous situation. Is she getting proper therapy to help deal with what must be just a permanently scarring experience?
Yeah. So what MB experienced, no individual should ever have to go through that. That she was a child while she's experiencing, still a child, the need for having supports in place is vital. And presently, MB is getting counseling. She's in various support groups. Her family nucleus is coming back together again with the support of social workers and case managers from the city who've done a nice job. So she is getting some support, and I think that the important point is that because she's so young, they're trying to create some sense of normalcy in her life so they can sort of retrack this child that's been so derailed.
Right, right. Let's talk a little bit about the procedural history of the case. You are suing the motel's owner and the resident manager?
We are. The lawsuit names the motel manager, Yagna Patel. It names the motel, that is the Roosevelt Inn, and then it names the management company that managed the property. The management company also manages other properties throughout the country, but it managed this particular property. So there are three main entities identified. They all have other corporate names as well.
Now, I understand that the traffickers in MB's case were actually convicted and are serving prison sentences. Does that help your case in terms of proving the underlying facts?
Simple answer is yes. So in many of these cases, a lot of difficult issues come about. One, that's ever getting a hold of the traffickers or the people that compelled these young kids to do these things. In this particular case, the traffickers were prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the bad people criminally have been prosecuted and have gone away.
And I'm just curious in terms of how, in general, you go about investigating this kind of case. For example, were staff at the motel interviewed about their knowledge?
So, Heidi, at this point, we're in the case is progressing. We're in the initial stages of what's called discovery.
Right.
And that is the exchange of both written and deposition testimony. We have information with regard to what went on at the motel at certain times. Not surprising, we had this outpour of people coming forward and discussing with us or revealing to us information that they knew about the Roosevelt Inn and about what might have gone on there at different times. So the staff will be interviewed. Mr. Patel and people in management will be interviewed, and other information will be exchanged along the way.
I understand that some of those additional commercial properties outside of Pennsylvania are also in our state of New York, as well as New Jersey and Illinois. What I'm wondering is, if you prevail in this case, do you think any of those other properties might be scrutinized by prosecutors in other states? Is this kind of thing that's sort of shared with other attorneys?
So I think that at this point the case is focused on the activities that occurred at the Roosevelt Inn here in Philadelphia, that this management company manages properties all around the country, and I'd like, as you mentioned, in New York, New Jersey, Chicago perhaps, or the Chicago area. Will there be some investigation into those? I imagine that seems like a likely consequence of this lawsuit. That is not where we are headed with our lawsuit, though.
Right, right. Understand. I wanted to ask, if I might, Nadim, a personal question. I remember when I was in law school, also at Temple years ago, I interned at the Philadelphia Defender Association, and I worked on a death penalty project where we were reviewing old files from all the death-eligible cases of Philadelphia. And some of the fact patterns were jarring, and it must take a personal toll to deal with this kind of human trafficking case. How do you cope with that?
So Heidi, that's a nice question. It's a question I don't often get asked professionally. I get asked it more in my home life and private life. So I look at it this way. At this stage in my career, after doing this type of work for so many years, I have the opportunity every morning to wake up and to help somebody that has been harmed beyond most imaginations. And that I can do that for somebody has me racing out the door in the morning and continuing to try to help these people. And so I think of it that as my coping mechanism, not that I'm tired and I'm run down, but that I have an opportunity to do something wonderful for people. I've said this before. I believe that the press that this case has received and some of the other abuse cases that I've worked on have created awareness. And the important point is, if there's awareness, we've saved lives. Just the airing of this show will save lives.
Mm.
And that's my therapy.
That's so, so inspiring. I also note that you handle some sexual assault cases on university campuses. Is that also a rampant problem?
It has been. It has been for years. I think that children and young adults on college campuses have crossed the line often, do so every weekend, at times make poor decisions, and at times they make poor decisions that affect the lives of other children and victimize other people. And I think that schools have done a real good job at paying attention to what's going on their campuses, the enactment of Title IX and the investigation into accidents and unfortunate events surrounding alcohol use on campus has really made a difference. There's a long way to go still, but it's an important part of our society and our culture that we need to keep an eye on.
When you were talking about young people, it dawned on me, do you ever encounter traffickers who themselves are relatively young? So, or a related question is, do some victims themselves ever go on, in your experience, to become abusers of others or to bring other people into this?
So I can't speak statistically about the number of kids that have been abused that go on to then work as traffickers. I could see how it's a logical extension, but I don't have any direct experience.
Right.
In terms of the traffickers now that we're dealing with and that we're seeing, the way I would phrase it is none of them are old. I don't think that I've come across a trafficker that is 30 or older. They're all in their 20s. They're young, they're mobile, they're willing to do and things that are unspeakable and compel children to do things that are unspeakable. And they're also not who you think. They're not driving big, huge cars and wearing electric clothing and quite visible at all hours of the day. They are working what I call square jobs during the day, and they are doing these horrible things to people in the evening.
Oh, that's fascinating. You make me ask the question, how much money is involved in some of these transactions?
I think the sex industry business is a multi-billion dollar a year business. If I were, I don't know that I could parcel out what's made on the internet through the sale of pornography and illegal pornography, but I would tell you that trafficking itself is a multi-billion dollar a year industry. I think that the individuals that are doing it, the traffickers themselves, are making quite a bit of money and are in it for the money.
And was MB receiving any money in addition to, I guess, her room and board?
So MB was getting, as you mentioned, a place to stay. She was getting minimal food. Her habit, to the extent that she had one, was being fed. And she was permitted to keep some of the money that she was paid for being forced to have sex. There are instances where some of the victims are allowed to keep as much as half of what they earn. I guess earn is the word I would use, for having sex. But that varies, and I think it varies depending upon the trafficker.
Right. Nadeem Bazar, it has been such an honor to have you on the show. We really applaud the work you're doing, this case and others, and want to thank you for making a difference in the lives of so many young persons.
Heidi, thank you very much, and again, thank you for taking the time to air these matters. These are very, very critical matters to our society, and I appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Nearly 20 million television viewers tuned in to hear former FBI Director James Comey testify before Congress on June 8 and explain that he recorded his conversations with President Trump because he did not trust him. Despite the Trump administration's assertions to the contrary, most legal experts say that Comey's sharing the memos about his interactions with Trump is perfectly legal. Several whistleblower attorneys are among those, asserting that Comey's handing over the memos to a friend to be leaked to the press violated no laws.
The information, they say, was neither classified nor secret as a matter of federal law. And Comey revealed a matter of public interest and had a right to expose these facts, and to do so anonymously. Joining us today is Lewis Clark, Executive Director and Chief Executive Officer of the Government Accountability Project in Washington, D.C. The GAP is the nation's leading whistleblower protection and advocacy organization. It litigates whistleblower cases, helps expose wrongdoing to the public, and promotes government and corporate accountability. And for four decades, the GAP has assisted over 6,000 whistleblowers. Lewis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's great to be with you.
A lot of Americans tuned in recently to watch former FBI Director James Comey testify before Congress. And there's a lot of talk about whether he was a leaker or, in fact, a whistleblower. Can you please explain the difference to our listeners?
Yes. A whistleblower is a person who is blowing the whistle on wrongdoing, abuse of authority, illegality, specific health and safety dangers, gross waste, gross mismanagement. All those categories of wrongdoing or problems are what whistleblowers reveal. On the other hand, a leaker usually is someone who is trying to gain some kind of political advantage within an office, is trying to put information forward that's detrimental to an opponent, perhaps within an administration. For example, recently at the White House, there's been quite a bit of leaking around which faction might be attacking another faction. And that's a very common leaker type of phenomena. It usually doesn't have much to do with the public interest at all.
Okay, and I understand that having to do with the public interest is actually part of the definition of a whistleblower.
That's right.
Now, is Mr. Comey protected by the Whistleblower Protection Act?
No, he is not, for two reasons. One, if the FBI is exempt from the Whistleblower Protection Act, so that puts him outside the statute altogether as an FBI person. And then in addition to that, political appointees are not covered under the Whistleblower Protection Act.
A lot of people are talking about whether he can be punished, and I know that Mr. Trump has tweeted a bit about this. Was the act of handing over memos memorializing his conversations with President Trump something that he can be punished for?
No. There's no basis under the law to punish him for doing that.
Why is anonymity important in a general for whistleblowers?
Well, because of the retaliation that they often suffer. And so if they are able to blow the whistle without identifying themselves, then certainly the issue might focus on the problem that the whistleblower has raised, as opposed to the emphasis being on the whistleblower, him or herself, and then all the media perhaps will focus on the whistleblower as opposed to the problem that the whistleblower has presented.
I understand that fellow whistleblower attorney Stephen Cohn has said that Trump's threat to initiate an investigation might actually be considered obstruction, or as you just referred to, retaliation for what Comey said, what Comey did. What do you think of that observation?
I think there's a solid basis for saying that, because one is what Mr. Comey was talking about was a potential obstruction of justice. And so if you're taking retaliation against a person who has presented that possibility, then certainly it looks to be retaliatory.
Are you aware of any other instances in which federal government officials of Mr. Comey's level have ever done anything like this before?
I would say it's rather rare that something like this would happen. Hazel O'Leary, who was the Secretary of Energy during the Clinton administration, did blow the whistle, in our view, on the torture that had occurred, actually. Well, I should say she had blown the whistle about the contamination of workers and the contamination of innocent people like children by nuclear radiation that occurred during the 50s. And she revealed this, and many people, including ourselves, thought she was a whistleblower as a result.
Before I ask you about the state of whistleblower laws, I read recently, and it was one of the few commentaries that I read that said that Comey was improper in doing what he did. But law professor Jonathan Turley actually says the memos were FBI information and that Comey violated federal rules by not informing the Department of Justice. And in his opinion, it doesn't matter if the information wasn't classified. He also says that leaking through a third party, namely his friend at Columbia University, diminished the value of these memos to federal investigators. Do you agree with that assertion?
No, I disagree with that position. And furthermore, in terms of these memos, here we have a person who is being called by the president a nut job, and has been called a liar by the president, and the president has also fired him. And so for anyone to say that a regulation does not allow a person like Mr. Comey to defend himself, that doesn't make sense at all. And furthermore, there is the First Amendment. He was no longer an employee of the Justice Department, and because he was fired. So therefore, it's hard to say that he was obligated by regulations not to reveal the memo that he prepared about his own conversation with the President of the United States. So that doesn't make sense to me. Furthermore, there is such a thing as the First Amendment. And so a person, if you have a contest between a regulation of an agency and the First Amendment, I definitely think the First Amendment would trump any they might put forward to limit a person's freedom of speech.
Right. And President Trump, we remember, impugned the reputation when Comey was still director of the FBI by saying that a lot of the people working for him didn't respect him. I want to talk briefly about the case of Federal Air Marshal Robert McLean. His case has been raised in connection with allegations that Mr. Comey acted improperly by sharing information with the media. Can you tell us briefly what did Air Marshal Robert McLean do?
Robert McLean blew the whistle on the decision of the Transportation Safety Administration to take air marshals off of transcontinental flights in the midst of a confirmed terrorist threat to exactly those type of flights. He blew the whistle to the media anonymously, and within 24 hours, the agency changed its position and said that the order was a mistake. But then the agency discovered who had blown the whistle on that regulation. And he ended up being fired. And so we took the case to the Supreme Court. The legal struggle has gone on for 10 years on his behalf. And the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Robert McLean by 7-2. And what it ruled is that an agency regulation cannot trump, using that term again, cannot trump a statute. In that case, they were talking about the Whistleblower Protection Act. I don't see how that applies to this case in the sense that Comey was not covered by the Whistleblower Protection Act. So I'm not sure, other than to say that an agency regulation cannot essentially undermine a person's right to speak out. So in that sense, there might be a correlation.
Over the years, many people have observed that sometimes the government itself leaks information and that there's a double standard. Can you think of an example in which a recent administration has let information make its way to the press this
way. Mr. Comey itself.
Mr. Comey.
He found out from the television. He was, you know, so that's, if that wasn't leaking, I don't know what is. And also in the case of Valerie Plame, for example, and this is going back a few years, but her husband had essentially blown the whistle on the Bush administration in terms of evidence leading up to the Iraq War, and she was singled out by the government, and they revealed her identity as a CIA operative, and her career was essentially ended. That's essentially, I think it's more important to note that it's a common practice every day throughout the federal government that high government officials leak information to the media. Often it's a kind of trial balloon for a policy that they're intending to pursue.
Right, and in the case of Valerie, as you mentioned, that put her life in danger because that kind of information is usually guarded with the utmost of care. So that did seem clearly retaliatory.
Yes, in that case, it was certainly retaliatory.
In our few remaining minutes, Lewis, can you tell our listeners about the Government Accountability Project's National Security and Human Rights Program? What kinds of improper actions do government agencies take against whistleblowers?
Well, we represent whistleblowers throughout the government, but and as well as corporations, but our national security pointed out does focus heavily on the intelligence agencies, and which also includes the Department of Defense. And what we do, whistleblowers are constantly, you know, coming forward and revealing how investigations, for example, might be essentially undermined through, you know, bureaucratic practices. I think a good example of that is the case of Thomas Drake, who blew the whistle at the National Security Agency. Then what happened is there was an investigation at the department, and that investigation had essentially was confirming what Thomas Drake and other whistleblowers at the National Security Agency were finding, and yet what ended up happening is the investigation ended up they ended up destroying the documents that substantiated the claims from the whistleblowers. And then they ended up prosecuting Thomas Drake, and he, of course, completely prevailed, and that prosecution ended in an embarrassment to the Department of Justice.
Lewis, tell listeners, how can they learn more about the work of the Government Accountability Project? What's your website?
Our website is www.whistleblower.org.
I want to thank you so much for joining us on Law and Disorder. And on behalf of my co-host, Michael Smith, who's not here today, we want to thank you for the really critical work that your organization does defending whistleblowers.
Thank you so much. And thank you for this opportunity to talk to you as well as to all your listeners.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
For many, the word Watergate is synonymous with political corruption. The scandal was revealed when five burglars were caught by Washington police in the Democratic National Committee's office on June 17, 1972, and ended with the resignation of President Nixon in 1974. Richard Nixon was the first American president who felt compelled to resign because of the severity of the situation. And the role of the press was critical in this episode. It began with the Washington Post's front-page reporting. And at first, the role of television, with the notable exception of CBS, was scant. The credit of responsible reporting went largely to Washington Post editor Katharine Graham and co-editor Ben Bradley, as well, of course, to reporters Woodward and Bernstein. They covered the story at great threat to their own lives and those of their families. The president and his staff in the White House made every possible effort to resist and downgrade the true news stories of the reporters. Staff threatened the journalists with verbal attacks. And it also created the Washington Star to counter the Washington Post and anti-government reporting. Nixon also sought the assistance of the Federal Communication Commission to ban two television channels in Florida. The administration had devised such plans that the government officials began to avoid meeting with Woodward and Bernstein. Joining us today to talk about the modern media and the recent Comey testimony before Congress is Dave Saldana. Dave is an award-winning journalist and attorney and a longtime member of the National Lawyers Guild. He's a litigation consultant with the law firm of Garagos & Garagos in Los Angeles. Welcome, Dave, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi. It's a pleasure to be here. Always nice to speak with you.
Dave, I want to start by talking about some old-fashioned journalistic principles. When you were in journalism school, what were the driving principles you learned about reporting?
Well, the first and foremost, sort of the be-all and end-all is get it right. Accuracy and truth, you know, to the best way that you can get to it. It's vitally important that what you report is the best information that you can put forth. And unfortunately, in a lot of ways today, is, you know, given the 24-hour news window now, and you know, with a lot of reporters using Twitter and a lot of news outlets publishing on Facebook and other places online, speed has become a driving force, and speed and accuracy are not always friendly.
And the limited number of characters in Twitter. A lot of people are saying that the recent former FBI Director Comey's testimony before Congress and a lot of the allegations that are surfacing about administration possible ties to Russia is reminding them of Watergate. How do you think the Watergate case influenced the next generation of journalists?
In some positive ways, I mean, it proved the value of the news media and its importance in the running of a democracy, but it was not all positive. We've come to a situation where scandal is its own reward, not necessarily a benefit to the public. You know, everybody's looking for the smoking gun, and sometimes there just isn't one. And sometimes the hype never meets the facts. And also, you know, as a result of Nixon being hounded out of office, you know, it sets the stage for this sort of fallback position amongst conservatives that the liberal media is out to get them. And we know that that's simply not true. You know, even William Kristol, one of the leading neoconservatives, has admitted, you know, as early as 1995, actually, that the attacks on the, quote, liberal media were never really legitimate, but were a way of working the ref, so to speak, and getting the public to look sideways at everything the media said. And it was just a way for them also to distract from their own failings as a political movement. You know, if you can blame the messenger for presenting your foibles and failures to the public, you know, you don't have to take ownership of them.
Oh, I wonder if Watergate, the cases behind that, were to break today, do you think it would be covered differently than several decades ago? Would it be deemed purely political?
I think it would. I mean, we're seeing that with the many, well, to use the legalistic term, the alleged corruptions of the Trump administration. You know, the response is to attack the media. You know, as if you know, reporters are out manufacturing false evidence. That's simply not true. You know, I've worked in the media for, you know, my adult life in one facet or another, and the perception actually on both sides, the left and the right, that the media is out to get them, or the media is serving a master other than the truth, really isn't, really doesn't present itself that way. There is censorship of a sort, but there's nobody from corporate telling you that you can or cannot publish or broadcast something with a particular bent, quite so much as it's a culture of corporate ownership that impacts how you present something. You know what your boss's politics are, we'll put it that way. And that leads to self-censorship, which, you know, I think most people would agree is far more dangerous, because you never test boundaries when you're self-censoring.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And you touched on something that I wanted to ask you about, namely, how have multinational corporations and the big media conglomerates that we have impacted news reporting, and especially investigative reporting? The old newspapers, the independent press, that used to really make that a focus.
When I started in television in 1991, it had already started and had already been rolling downhill. That snowball it now crushes everything in its path, and that is that news, in the great days of Edward R. Murrow at CBS, news was considered a good of itself. It was an investment. It was something that you would, that a network would take pride in. You know, that's how CBS became the Tiffany Network.
Tiffany Network?
It's the standard bearer. It's
right.
the finest, like Tiffany's jewelry. It's the finest you can get. And that was a point of pride for everyone who worked at CBS. We've got a great heritage of broadcast news coming out of there, from Walter Cronkite to Dan Rather and Don Hewitt and all of the folks at 60 Minutes. But that's no longer the case. Now it's a profit center. The proliferation of shows like Dateline. When Dateline started, it was supposed to be in direct competition with 60 Minutes, which does those investigative, in-depth pieces about important matters. It also does some fluffy celebrity stuff now and again, but, a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down and all of that. 2020 on ABC similarly started as an investigative news magazine. And now what you see with Dateline and 2020 is it's the murder of the week. The pretty blonde wife, and did her husband do it? Yes, he did. It's
right.
It's a murder. It's real life murder mysteries. Whereas 60 Minutes, God bless them, still does those. This is how the lead got into the water in Flint. That stuff is important. That stuff matters. That stuff is why the First Amendment protects the media. Protects the press. There's a school of thought amongst lawyers, and I'm one of them, who believe that, the First Amendment is first for a reason. And that's because if the people can't talk about and see and read and understand what's going on around them, the rest of the rights become sort of moot. And that's why the press is the only profession protected by the Constitution.
Dave, over the last many years, it seems that we've seen an increase in leaks and whistleblowers. We've always had that, of course, to the press. But I think that with cuts in budgets for investigative reporting and the rapid proliferation of technology, including hacking and hacktivism, we have seen really major stories break as a result of leaks and whistleblowing. Do you think that trend is going to continue as we have, in many respects, an increasingly secret government and a government, an administration that especially right now is really antagonistic toward the news media?
I think it has to. That trend has to continue. Otherwise, we're in a much deeper pit than we thought we were. I mean, what would we know about what happened in Iraq, if not for Chelsea Manning? what would we know if not for Edward Snowden and recently a reality winner, taking very, very difficult steps and at great personal risk to tell these stories based on, if that's not something to, that continues to happen with people with conscience within the government taking those steps at great personal risk, we're slaves to what the government chooses for us to know. And that's not the way it's supposed to operate. I mean, there are laws, federal and state, all across the nation, protecting whistleblowers. Unfortunately, most of those laws exclude government employees from their protections. You know, it's perfectly good for a corporate whistleblower to say, hey, this company is cheating its customers, or this company is putting the environment at risk, and here are the documents that prove it, and now I'm protected from retaliation. Well, I think our democracy deserves at least that level of protection, that people who see wrongdoing, who see malfeasance, who go through the first steps of the going through their supervisory chain and find out that they're being stonewalled, well, they need to have a route to make that information public. I mean, we're the ones who are paying for it. It's being done in our names. When the government acts badly, it's our right to know these things.
I know that you and I both watched the recent testimony of former FBI Director James Comey before Congress. You know, I've got to say, I thought it was riveting television. What did you think of it?
I mean, from pure theater, I don't think Comey could have done a much better job. I don't think it was possible to do a much better job. He seemed extremely forthright. He knew what he was talking about. I didn't get to see all of Attorney General Sessions' testimony, but he seemed to be, that is, Attorney General Sessions, seemed to be dodging and trying not to answer questions. And the former FBI Director Comey was seemed to be very, very forthright and seemed to be really commanding of the facts. Whereas I didn't get to see all of Attorney General Sessions' testimony, but from what I saw, he seemed to be avoiding. He seemed to be trying to dodge questions. He seemed fishing for answers, and that really hurts his credibility. And former Director Comey was quite the opposite. So just as a matter of theater, you know, which witness do you think the jury is going to believe? I think Director Comey came out well ahead, and I think, you know, should the public care, and that's still a question, unfortunately, should it actually have any impact, that I think that Director Comey's testimony could be the John Dean testimony, to go back to the Watergate analogy, where, you know, there is a cancer on the presidency, and Director Comey knows what it is.
You mentioned a few names of media giants earlier. Who are some of your modern-day heroes in the media?
Well, there are a lot of independent journalists who do fantastic work. Heather Digby Parton, I think, is one of the top aggregators. She tends to aggregate a lot of information and then boils it down to a very fine point. Marcy Wheeler, I don't think there's anybody who digs as deep as she does. I mean, she put together, she connected a lot of dots about what was happening in Iraq during the Bush administration that nobody else did. And currently, one of the people I follow quite closely is Larissa Alexandrovna. She's an independent reporter, works a lot in the alternative media, and she happens to be a Ukrainian immigrant. So she knows an awful lot about the Russian mob and how money gets laundered, and she keeps saying to follow the money on what's happening with the Trump administration and its relationship with Russia, not just the government, but also the Russian mob. They're very active in the construction and real estate worlds that our current president came from.
Interesting. Now, speaking of that, by the time this show airs, it will be a week ago that U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions called his collusion with Russia or the allegations of that, a, quote, detestable lie. What are we to read between the lines at this point with respect to significant evidence of possible collusion between the Trump administration and Russian leaders?
Well, I think it's important to acknowledge what we don't know. I mean, we've heard a lot of rumors. There's been a lot of reports, but that evidence is not before the public yet. I mean, personally, do I believe that there was collusion? Probably, but I don't know it. I don't know that to be true. Nobody has put the evidence in front of me. So healthy skepticism cuts both ways. When it goes for you and when it goes against you, you should have that healthy skepticism. There's the notion that what we're not hearing is telling us an important story as well. One of the big facts that came out of Sessions' testimony was the Trump administration doesn't seem to care very much or doesn't have many questions about Russian collusion and whether there was hacking. Well, what does that tell you? If they don't care, is it because they don't think it's a big deal or because they know about it? Right? I don't have an answer to that question, but it sure is suspicious, isn't it?
It's suspicious, and I agree with you. For me and many others I know, that was perhaps the biggest takeaway, the almost surprising level of apathy, and I think Comey touched on that effectively during his testimony. This should be something that should be of top concern by the government, the U.S. government.
At this point in our history, you know, not to speak too grandly about it, but the independent press is under attack by an administration, and we already see that, you know, the conservative tendency to shoot the messenger is being given, you know, in some cases quite literal attention, where, you know, journalists are being beaten and attacked. You know, the conservative base applauds it. That's very scary, particularly when we're in a situation where we essentially have one-party rule. The Democrats are incapable at this point of putting any checks or accountability on the administration or on either house of Congress. So we essentially have one-party rule, and that one party has literally called the media the enemy of the people. That's a scary thing. You know, at the risk of repeating myself, the First Amendment is first for a reason. The press is protected by the Constitution for a reason. And if the people don't stand up and defend that press freedom, then you become slaves to what the government wants you to know.
Well, Dave,
and that's not always the truth.
Exactly. And I think that's a fitting point on which to conclude. But before we do that, Dave, I want to thank you for your work over the years in the legal field and especially in the media and First Amendment field for educating and advocating on behalf of a robust First Amendment. And we hope that we can call on you in the future for your media analysis.
I hope you do. And thank you for those very kind words, Heidi. It means very much to me, coming from someone I respect and admire very greatly.
Aw, Dave, thank you. All right, well, we'll let you go for now, but we hope to talk to you again soon.
You know where to find me.
Okay.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.